I'll do a quick introduction. I think, given that we've got a few folks in class here who are new, we haven't seen that the advertisement has drawn some additional interest, which is good. Ephraim and Asher are two gentlemen who came to our debate between John Loftus and David Wood the other night. And we started a conversation and found them to be interesting, highly intelligent, and people with something to say. And so as a result, we, of course, invited them to Solid Ground. And I think we in Solid Ground have talked a lot about Judaism in general and kind of background to Christianity. You've heard me say things in class about there are some things that Christians have forgotten from the Jewish tradition, specifically, namely, that Jesus and all that Christianity may have forgotten it. Jesus was Jewish, all the apostles were Jewish, the writers of the New Testament were Jewish, with one exception, basically. Maybe a couple other things that people generally don't know. I'll do this in the form of a quiz. Does anybody know the non-anglicized name Jude in the New Testament, the book? What was the original name? Anybody know? Judah. So it was Judah, and it got anglicized through Latin into Jude. Even a little bit more of a twist, James, the book of James. James, there is no James the apostle. That is Yusuf that got turned into a Hellenized version of Yusuf that then got turned into a Latinized version that got turned into an anglicized version, and James comes out the other end. Anybody know the Irish name James? Seamus?
Yeah.
So if you ever heard of Seamus, Seamus and James are the same thing. One's Irish, one's English. Anyway, James in your New Testament is actually Yusuf, Joseph. So some things that we have forgotten, and so I think reminding of it would be interesting. And of course, maybe one of the number one questions in Christianity is, why do the Jews not believe in the Messiah, if Jesus is the Messiah? Well, we've got two gentlemen that are probably going to have many excellent reasons as to why that is, and we've invited them here to both talk about that, and then, of course, to talk about anything else that they think would be appropriate. So I basically left the field up as open as this. Gentlemen, come on in. The floor is yours. Say what you think is something that we'd be interested in hearing. And so, let me know if this is the case, but what we probably do is it looks like Asher's going to do... Ephraim's going to do most of the talking.
Okay. We've split it up.
Okay, perfect. Let them have the floor sans questions. I know it's not normally Solid Ground protocol, but let them just roll until they wish to either allow questions or if they want to go to the end and keep talking, that's on them too. They will also come back next week, and they'll tell you how they want to divide it up. The bottom line is you've got 2 weeks, and there will be, of course, I assume, some time for question and answers too. Additionally, I'll put this out again at the end. I'm sure they'll put it out. They run a Pal Talk forum. If you're not familiar with Pal Talk, if you imagine kind of those internet boards like Reddit where people post, this is the exciting version of that. You can go into and have audio interaction with people in the room. So imagine a chat room, but instead of doing it on text, which you can do on text as well, but you can also do it audibly. And so those can be a lot of fun and a lot of high energy and informative too. But we'll put that up on the board towards the end of class. And I think, actually, I sent out the link on Facebook. I'll send it out on email as well. Well, stealing too much further time, I'll introduce Ephraim. Do you go commonly by Effie? Or
Effie is what I'll
go by. Effie, okay, and Asher, who are going to talk to us. Gentlemen, please.
Thank you. So I think we'll start with this. On myself, I did my bachelor's degree in Judaic Studies at Torah College. I'm not a PhD student yet. I'm a graduate student. Right now, I'm finishing off what in Israel is called a PGCE. It's a postgraduate certificate in Jewish education, specifically to teach at Israeli universities and like American colleges and stuff like that that specialize in Jewish studies. I'm doing it in the didactics of teaching Talmudic literature and oral law. I'm born to Jewish parents, same thing with himself, but my parents are actually secular. They believe in God, but they don't practice Judaism at all. So they don't eat kosher food, they don't practice the religion, they don't do anything like that. So throughout my childhood, I just basically did everything that every other normal kid did. I played soccer for a long time, and it was on Shabbat, on Saturday, and so on. And so growing up, that's how it was for me. However, one thing my parents did make me do was martial arts. When I was 5 years old, they got me very, very heavy into it. At the age of 10, I fell in love with it. By my teen years, I fell in love with Zen Buddhism. Absolutely. I thought Zen Buddhism was the best thing ever. And so I was reading up on Zen Buddhism. I was all into Tibetan Buddhism. My friend Inchun Kim, one of my very best friends, was really, really into Tibetan Buddhism, and he was doing stuff, I was doing stuff, and all that kind of stuff, right? So at the age of 20, I moved to California. My specialty is actually I'm a security consultant. And while I was living in Los Angeles, I worked for several celebrities. The three R's is Roseanne, Cher, and Janet Jackson. Well, one of the person that I'm working for and with is actually a born-again Christian. One day, while we are doing our firearm certifications, he brings out his Bible while we are traveling in the car. And I said, hey man, because I was, of course, a Zen Buddhist and I'm all into spirituality. Hey, can I see this? He's like, sure. So I open it up and it's the book of Proverbs. And I'm flipping through it. Man, this is really cool stuff. And then after that, I'm going over to Psalms. This is really cool stuff. We do our firearm certification. We get out and I'm still flipping through the Bible as we're going home. That night, him and I had the biggest discussion ever, and I was telling him why I don't believe in the Bible, why I don't believe in Christianity, and so on. So as a result, he gave me all credible answers, the first time that I've ever heard. And as a result of that, I ended up 11/11/97. I became a born-again Christian. Later, I started going to what? An Israeli security company had hired me to work with them. They actually pulled me into going back to synagogue. Hey, come to the synagogue, you don't understand what we are talking about. And something that Scott just said a minute ago, so anglicized names, Peter, John, Yohanan, Isaiah, so on. So I'm having conversations with my friend, his name is Ohad, and he's full-blown Israeli, only speaks Hebrew, but he speaks some English too. And I'm like, well, the prophet Isaiah says this. And he goes, who's Isaiah? He didn't know who Isaiah is. Effie, what is Isaiah in Hebrew?
Yeshayahu.
I'm talking Jeremiah. Which Jeremiah?
Yirmiyahu.
He has no idea who I'm talking about. And I'm flipping over in an English Bible, and he goes, I don't recognize any of this. So as a result, I went and I got a Hebrew-English Bible, and him and I started hardcore debate with each other. And I was picking up all the counter-missionary Judaism stuff that fights against Christian missionaries and so on, and I did not find that stuff credible. I think it was absolutely worth nothing. It was yuck. It was nothing. So as a result, over the years, I started doing my own study outside of that. I ended up, not for any mean reasons or anything like that, I just came to the persuasion that I believe that rabbinic Judaism is the correct way and that Christianity is not. So my relationship with Christianity is not so antagonistic as that you might find if you went to your local synagogue or something like that. Because I understand the Christian mind, the Christian worldview. I don't think that Christians are stupid for believing in Jesus as the Messiah or anything like that. Correct?
Correct.
And so as a result, I'm actually, as he pointed out, an admin in a Christian-owned debate room that's on a system called PalTalk. And with that, him and I, we moderate this. We're one of only three Jews there because we play fair with the rules. No personal attacks, no anything like that. And so that's what we do. And so with no further ado, what I want to do is we're going to divide this thing up into four parts. Two parts today, and then two parts next week. So you want to come up and we'll start with the four parts. He's going to do the first two.
Awesome.
Okay.
So one, we should wish all the mothers Happy Mother's Day. You came out, that's awesome. And two, we just really would like to thank all of you for this opportunity. It's not these kind of conversations don't necessarily take place that often in our world. And usually people try to avoid both religion and politics. And so this is an opportunity to talk about something that clearly is meaningful both to you and to us. So So the part that I'm going to deal with is really two main issues, and it's really to give a backdrop to what Asher is going to be talking about. Those two main issues are, one, the three concepts that are most central to Judaism, and then, two, specifically, the concept of the canon of Judaism, i.e. those texts which are seen as authoritative for Jews. Now, Asher then is going to talk about two things today. One is going to be the Jewish expectations of the Messiah, and then, two, why Judaism is not convinced by Christianity's claims regarding Jesus being the Messiah. And so that's how we've kind of divided it up. Now, a couple things. One, I have one request. If there's a word that either Asher or I use, especially if it's a Hebrew word or Aramaic word, and we forget to translate it or we forget to define it, please raise your hand, stop us right there and say, hey, I don't know what this word is, could you please tell us? That would be of great help to us. And then a couple caveats. One, we're really doing a very broad brushstroke of these topics. These are very detailed issues. We're leaving a lot out. We're just trying to give you a sense of what's out there as far as Judaism is concerned. Second, we realize there are really two approaches to this kind of material. One, as I'm doing a PhD, I recognize that there's an academic approach to this material. That we're not going to be discussing. Rather, we're going to be discussing the religion's viewpoint of this, specifically Judaism's viewpoint of these kinds of topics. And then another caveat fits into that. Obviously, you see us, we're wearing kippot. That's what these are called. They're head coverings. A kippah is a covering. In Aramaic, it's called a yarmulke. It means reverence for heaven, fear of God, fear of heaven. We recognize that there's a wide range within Judaism. There's very liberal forms of Judaism, the Reform movement, for example, and there are very what would be called conservative forms of Judaism, small c, which would be the Orthodox. We're talking from the Orthodox vantage point, could be called the Torah Judaism, could be called traditional Judaism, but that's where we're coming from, and I'm not going to use the word Orthodox ever again. That's just the default as far as our conversation is going, if that's okay with you folks. Awesome. Now, there are three major issues that almost everything in Judaism revolves around. Yes?
Just an interjection. I won't do this as often, please. But for our own clarity, if what you're wondering is, how does that spectrum fit like us? In, to my mind, that which has gone into the name of Orthodox Judaism is closest to what we would call Protestant believers who are actual Christians. You know, sometimes we say there's a lot of people who go by the name of Christ, but the number of people who are actual Christians would be narrower, and you say, well, how do you know who those people are? Well, they adhere to the central doctrines of Christianity, they act like they believe they're true, all that kind of. Orthodox Judaism is that analog. It's the form of Judaism that acts like the Torah, the Tanakh, and all these things are true. So, in my opinion, these are the true believers. And tell me if I'm wrong on this one. You are actually the generations closest to the way of the Pharisees of ancient times.
Yeah, that's
the Sanhedrin is something that may come back. And so if you're kind of wondering about how does that look, what was the milieu in which Jesus was speaking, this one is, in my opinion, the closest to that, if not identical to that.
Yeah, actually, next week we're going to cover this aspect. So we're going to do things like when you see Jesus talking about them washing hands and stuff like that. We're going to show you what, from the time of Jesus till today, how they do the washing of their hands. You're going to see Jesus talking about that they make their fringes long and stuff like that. We're going to demonstrate what those things are. So all the connections that you guys see in the New Testament, all the way till the present day, you'll see what Judaism does and practices.
So the three major ideas or concepts that everything in Judaism revolves around in some aspects are God, Israel, and the Torah. For us, God is the God who created the universe. God is the one who redeemed Israel out of Egypt. God is the God who revealed himself to Mount Sinai. When we reference God, that is the God we're talking about. For Israel, Israel has really three or four different aspects to it. One, it's the people with whom God made covenant at Mount Sinai. So it's the people Israel. Two, it also references the land of Israel, the land which was promised to the patriarchs. And then three, it represents the language of Israel, which is Hebrew. So that is what we mean by that. But I'm going to focus specifically, since we're talking about the canon of Judaism, is on the concept of Torah and what Torah is. Because that is, for at least in this instance, what it concerns us the most. So just to give you a sense of how important Torah is and Torah study, I'd like to read to you from just a couple traditional Jewish texts to give so that you can kind of understand where we're coming from. So this particular book is called Pirkei Avot. What that means is the sayings of the fathers. It is one of the sections of a text called the Mishnah, which we'll talk about in a few minutes. And the Mishnah was compiled approximately 200 CE by a man by the name of Judah the Prince. Now, there are lots of sayings in here, and this is one of them. Simon the Righteous was among the last members of the Great Assembly. He would say, on three things the world depends: on Torah study, on the service of God, and on bestowing kindness. So one of the things that keeps the world going, that makes it sustain itself, is actually Torah study. That's how important the concept of Torah and Torah study is. Furthermore, in what is called a prayer book or a siddur, every morning, every Jew, when they're praying in the morning, says a particular blessing. And it lists a bunch of commandments, which we'll read here, and then notice the conclusion, how it sees this. These are the precepts that have no prescribed measure: the corner of the field which must be left for the poor, the first fruit offerings, the pilgrimage, the bestowal of kindness, and study of Torah. These are the precepts of which a person enjoys their fruits in this world, but whose principle remains intact for him in the world to come. These are they: honoring one's father and mother, the bestowal of kindness, early attendance at the house of study, morning and evening, hospitality to guests, visiting the sick, providing for a bride, escorting the dead, absorption in prayer, bringing peace between man and his fellow man, and man and his wife, and the study of the Torah is equivalent to them all. So you look at all of these commandments, and the study of Torah is, it's as if it represents all of these. Did you want to add one thing?
Yeah, sure. Exactly what Scott had mentioned last week, too, how important Torah study is. Both for Judaism and Christianity. We have a couple of statements. One is that the highest form of worshiping God is studying the Torah, or the highest form of worshiping God is studying the Bible. That would be an easy way to put it. I actually have a statement here from like the Talmud, the Mishnah, which you guys will see in your charts there in just a second. It says, if a mamzer, that is an illegitimate child, if an illegitimate child was a Torah scholar, and the high priest, in other words, the high priest that goes in on the Day of Atonement, etc. And if the high priest is an Am Ha'aretz, it means a person of the land. In this case, it means a person who's like an ignoramus. He really doesn't know what he's talking about. Then the mamzer, the illegitimate child, that's a Torah scholar, precedes even that of a person who's a hereditary high priest and has a function in the temple. So Judaism places that much emphasis on the study of the Bible, the Torah, etc.
So since you have the charts, let's look at them a little so I can explain how we use the word Torah. So the front chart here, what it has is so it says Torah for Mount Sinai. If you look at the top right, it says the Torah. The Torah in this instance is referring to the five books of Moses, what is called the Pentateuch: Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. You'll then notice the other two sections here right at the top are the prophets and the writings. In Judaism, we actually have a division of the Tanakh, is what we call it. That's the abbreviation, an acronym,
or what Christians will call it, the Old Testament, where there's a threefold division of the Old Testament into Torah, prophets, and writings. The writings would be things like Psalms, Proverbs, Lamentations. The prophets are going to be, of course, Ezekiel, Isaiah, Jeremiah, but some things you might be surprised about. Joshua, Judges, Samuel. So it ranges a little differently than what you might think. Now, the reason I actually have slightly different colors on them is for the following. For Judaism, we believe that the Torah itself, the five books of Moses, were literally revealed by God to Moses. In essence, Moses was the scribe, and he just wrote down exactly what was given to him by God. On the other hand, the prophets and the writings, if you read one of the promises that God gave Moses, is he said that to all the other prophets, I am going to speak to them in riddles, dreams, hints, visions. So it is, in essence, a lower level of intimacy, or what we would say lower level of prophecy than what Moses had. Moses had the highest level of prophecy out of all of the prophets of Israel. And then the writings would be just a step down from that. But this would all be considered part of the written Torah. That's the way we would refer to it in English. In Hebrew, it's Torah Shebechtah. The other word that we have for Torah, though, the other usage of it, is the oral Torah. The oral Torah actually refers to those things given by God to Moses, teachings, laws, or methods of interpretation of the written Torah. Things that were not necessarily included in the Torah as we have it as a text. And on this would be ranged from the Zohar, which was ultimately compiled by a rabbi by the name of Shimon Bar Yochai. This was done in 1st, 2nd century in northern Israel. But he wrote down the teachings that were given directly to Moses on Mount Sinai. Then we have what is called the Midrash. The Midrash refers to a collection of literature that deals with the backstory of what's going on in the Torah. So all of the details, the nitty-gritty, all of that type of material. Then we go down and we have what is called the six orders of the Mishnah. The Mishnah, as I mentioned earlier, which is what Pirkei Avot comes from, is a collection of oral law that was gathered together by a man by the name of Judah the Prince in approximately the 2nd century, 200 CE rather. And the reason he wrote it down was that there was a concern that with the dispersion, the destruction of the temple and exile, that we as a people would lose some of these teachings that were handed down from Moses, and so there was an urgency to write them down. However, the writing down of these things is in very cursory fashion. In other words, if I sat you down with a Mishnah and you tried to read it, even in an English translation, you wouldn't know what the heck was going on. Somebody would have to give you keys. In Hebrew, we call it Roshe Prakim. It's just like headlines. That's it. It's just giving you the titles of a chapter or a subsection and not much else in there. So you already have to either be taught or already know what's going on to understand that. Then after this, we have the Talmud, which we'll show you what a picture of the Talmud looks like in a second, a page. But the Talmud is a collection of conversations, dialogue regarding the Mishnah. In essence, we could talk about it as if it were a commentary on the Mishnah. Then further down, we have what is called the Mishnah Torah, or the second giving of the Torah. That might be one way of translating this, which was a compilation of all of the laws written down by Moses Maimonides. This was done around the 1100s. It's a vast set. And then further on, we have a book called the Shulchan Aruch. It's not one book, it's multi-volume, which is a codification of these laws according to four major topics. It is this, which was done by Yosef Karo in northern Israel, approximately 1500s. It is this that Jews rule today. In other words, if we were to compare the Talmud to the Shulchan Aruch, the Talmud, again, remember, is a commentary on the Mishnah. If we were to compare that to the Shulchan Aruch itself, the Talmud is actually that conversation. but I won't know necessarily what actually the law is that I'm supposed to do. It would be kind of like looking at the history of the development of, say, traffic laws here in the state of Virginia. Awesome, that's great, but what am I supposed to do when I see this red octagon sign that says stop? Where do I have to stop? The Shulchan Aruch is like that final book that you have, knowing exactly what you're supposed to do. So this, all of the light blue, is considered oral Torah, and this up here would be what is considered written Torah. Now, if you flip the page, you'll actually see what a printed page of the Talmud looks like. So on this printed page, to demonstrate that it is, in fact, portrayed, this was done as a result of printing. Prior to this, things were much different than this. But up here where you see the little nice little box here, if you look to your right, it says Mishnah text. That's the Mishnah itself. A little section of the Mishnah, a verse, and then below it, all the way in that center column, all the way down to that first gap, what you find is if you look to the left, it says Gemara. Gemara is another word for the word Talmud. So these are the actual conversations, dialogues, that we have going on in the Talmudic page here. And then in addition to that, you will see other sections here. There's one, the major commentary on this, on the comments that are being made or the dialogues that are being made in the Talmud, is done by a rabbi who lived in northern France around the 1100s. The acronym for him is Rashi, and other individuals themselves. Do you want to show them a page?
Yeah, sure. Actually, this is just one small volume. The volume actually spans from probably about right here all the way to about right here, yeah?
Yeah.
And so
70-some volumes.
This is one that is Hebrew, Aramaic, and English with commentary and stuff like that. So basically the page that you guys are looking at is right here. So it would almost be like if you guys had a Bible during the time of the apostles or during the early church fathers and stuff like that, you won't have chapters. You guys aren't going to have any kind of punctuation or nothing. So as a result of the printing press, thank God, that we're able to go ahead and do this kind of stuff and have things in a book form. What's actually fascinating is that the Apostle Paul mentions somewhere in one of his writings, in one of his 13 letters, he talks about a folio that they're carrying around. Some archaeologists from the Israel Antiquities Authority actually believe that this is one of the first instances of somebody talking about people having books that they were carrying around in some fashion. So, and it's actually the New Testament that makes the first mention of this.
So let's flip the page and let's go to the next little sheet that's here. Fortunately, somebody has actually done a diagram, basically, of a basic Talmudic page with all of the various individuals that are having this conversation. Now, if you notice, for example, if you look right under the word Babylonian Talmud, you'll see here Rav Abba Aricha Abba Bar Aibo. He's living in Nahariya, which is in Babylonia, around the 2nd, 3rd century. If you follow the lines that are coming off of this little box, you're going to see the individuals with who had conversations with him or he had conversations with. So if you just go to the right and a little down, you have a Rav Yirmiya, which also lived in Babylonia in the 3rd century, and so on and so forth. So that you can look, these range everywhere from the 1st century all the way up to the 15th and 16th centuries. These individuals were all in this dialogue, this grand conversation regarding the Mishnah and the oral Torah in general. So you can see how complicated a Talmudic page is. And in fact, despite all of the Aramaic I may know, and despite the fact that I'm an Orthodox Jew, if you were to set a page of Talmud in front of me and say, Effie, do you understand the discussion that's going on here? Without looking at anything else, my clear and unequivocal answer to you is fat chance. There is no way I can do it. I need somebody to teach me what's going on there. And even with all the helps that I may have access to, I still will not be able to understand this unless I have somebody who has already learned this from somebody else so that I then they can teach that to me. That's how complicated this kind of material is. Now, but the question you might ask is, well, that's really nice, but do you really think that there, why do you think that there may be something beyond the text, i.e. the biblical text that we're looking at? Well, let me give you a couple examples that may help you understand the issue that we're facing with a biblical text. Yeah?
And one quick, our second quick interjection, sorry. I want to underscore this because I actually think this is another key truth. What does that sound exactly like to you? What that process he just described is what? In Christianity. That's discipleship.
Discipleship.
That's the concept of when you see Jesus saying, and he unfolded the scriptures to them and showed the disciples what it meant. It's not saying the scripture is not enough. That's not the point. But the point is, there is a lot of learning that goes on that a person who has wisdom and who has heard from God on those kinds of things, or who has God's wisdom on it, will unfold it to a disciple. So this tradition that you're seeing, which I'm sure they'll cover next week, is part of what is shared between Judaism and Christianity. If you understand this mindset, you'll see why the disciples were following around Jesus. It's to do that.
So here's an example I'm going to give you. What do you think this says? Yes?
Woman without her man is nothing.
That's one possibility. Can you think of anything else that this might be saying?
What do you mean that's disgusting? What do you think it says?
No, I just meant that.
The concept.
The concept.
Is there any other possible reading of this? I can think of one.
I mean, I could just, a woman without hours of money is nothing.
A woman without her mind is nothing?
Possibly, except that misses
there's no
the D. I'll give you one other alternative to what she had said. I would agree with everything, except the other possibility is instead of man, it could be men. It's possible, right? It could be man or men. Maybe she is in multiple relationships with men, or she is in a relationship with just one man. So it can be read at least in two ways on this particular issue. Now, the reason I picked this particular one, and you are right, that's what I would say, that's the sentence I took and then removed the vowels. Now, why did I use this as an example of the dilemma we're facing? It's because Hebrew is not written with vowels. It is written with consonants. That's it. So you can see, without either somebody telling you what this is, it could go one way or another. Let me give you a specific example. If you go to Exodus 34:26, can somebody go there, please? And read it as it's translated in your text. Sarah, since I know you're the only name in here, I'm going to ask you to read it, please.
What was the verse again?
It's chapter, hold on, 34:26.
Bring the best of the first fruits of your soil to the house of the Lord your God. Do not cook a young goat in its mother's milk.
Now, what's interesting about this particular passage, get this out, is the following. Remember, Hebrew is not written with vowels. So the word where it says in the mother's milk is written like this. And then there's three consonants there. The consonants are chet, lamed, bet. There are two options for this. It could be b'chelev, which would mean fat, in the fat of its mother. Or it could be b'chalev, which means in the mother's milk. So chelev means fat, chalev means milk. Well, which is it? I mean, here's a law. Which is it? Now, here's what's interesting, just as a side note. If you were to go on, let's say, BibleHub.com, where you can type in a verse and see a variety of translations.
Funny you should mention that, because that's what I'm doing right now.
There you go. And each one of the translations that they have on their website, and I would probably argue that all of the translations you're aware of and that I'm aware of, say only one thing, milk, and its mother's milk. Well, where did they get that idea? It's not in the text itself, because it doesn't have vowels. They got it from tradition. Because if you really look at the source for how scholars have done this, back in the day, they didn't have lexicons. For example, Jerome, when he did the Vulgate, what did he do to figure out what the Hebrew Bible or Old Testament meant? I know what he did. He got on a boat, or he started walking until he got to Jerusalem. And then he sat down with some rabbis and said, excuse me, what does this mean? So the translation itself is dependent on something that's not in the text, tradition. Let me give you another thing. Now let's read this sentence again. Would you mind reading it one more time?
Woman without her man is nothing.
Now, how do we punctuate this? There are two major ways of punctuating this that I can think of. What might they be?
I would probably put a comma after woman.
Okay, let's do that. Woman.
After man, and then I would probably put another comma after man.
Okay. Is nothing. Which is why he was reacting to all that's a terrible idea. A woman without a man is nothing. How might you do it? Hold on. Let me erase the punctuation here.
Leave, yeah, just leave that one.
Yeah.
How would you do it?
A woman, without her, man is nothing.
Yeah. So you could put a colon, without her, comma, man is nothing.
That's more like it.
There you go.
Which one did you go to right away?
That would make sense.
Here's a challenge then. Remember, not only does Hebrew not have vowels written in it, i.e. we call them technically nekudot, or dots pointing, it doesn't have punctuation written in it. Let me give you another example. Go to Isaiah 40, verse 3.
Which is, what does tradition say is right in those two?
Of b'chalev, in milk. Oh, this? This is something that was just from English. I was playing with the English.
Isaiah 43.
Isaiah 40, verse 3. Anybody use the KJV here? Or in KJV? What does it say?
The voice of him that crieth in the wilderness, prepare ye the way of the Lord, make straight in the desert a highway for our God.
Excellent. So notice, what they say this is the voice of him that cries in the wilderness, comma, quote, prepare ye the way of the Lord, etc. Anybody use the ESV or NET? You? What do you have?
The ESV.
ESV, yeah, that'd be perfect.
A voice cries, in the wilderness, prepare the way of the Lord, make straight in the desert a highway for our God.
So notice, it's punctuating it slightly differently. It says a voice cries out, comma, quote, in the wilderness clear a way for the Lord. Construct in the desert a road for our God. Well, which is it? Without punctuation, it could be either. It is only through some sort of tradition that you're going to figure out which one was intended by the author. Because without that, you're just guessing. Now, let me cite one other instance. Let's go to Exodus 26, verse 30. Would somebody like to read that? Exodus 26, verse 30.
I'm surprised Scott hasn't memorized it.
Oh, he does. He just doesn't want to show off. Yes, please.
Set up the tabernacle according to the plan shown you on the mount.
Here's the question. This is Exodus chapter 26. If you look at all of the verses prior, do you see the plan mentioned, talked about, given, described? No, you don't. So what does this suggest to us? What this suggests to us is that God was in fact communicating with Moses, and there are instances of where we don't have this in the Torah. So if you ask yourself the question, is it reasonable to think that there is or are oral teachings that are outside of the biblical text that have been handed down and that we have access to, Yeah. I would submit to you it is reasonable. Asher, what would you say?
Yeah, like my friend Effie and I, we debate often. And so I told him, well, one of the counters could be all the things that you see written in the Torah is actually that, which is what God shared with Moses in this vision up there on the mountain. So that's one possibility. Or the other possibility is what he just stated. Either one, they're both reasonable. So we don't want people to think that necessarily that those in Orthodox Judaism or whatever have you, because they have a tradition, that they're going, well, where do you get this tradition from? There's nothing explicitly that states this in the Torah text itself, something like an oral Torah. So we're just demonstrating you where we derive such things. So it's that type of nature.
And because I'm doing a PhD, I do have to add one academic person. I apologize already right now. Even though I said I wouldn't, I couldn't help myself. I just couldn't. I tried. I couldn't. So there is a professor at the University of Chicago named Michael Fishbane, and he's written a book published by Oxford called Biblical Interpretation in Ancient Israel. And what he's trying to do is, the fancy term is to study the intertextuality of the biblical material. That's the technical term the academics use. In other words, how this material has been used throughout what we have as the Hebrew Bible or Old Testament. Here's one interesting note. He notes in talking about the Passover sacrifice and what you're supposed to do with it as far as how to eat it. He notes this regarding 2 Chronicles 35. Although it is stated in 2 Chronicles 35, 12, that the Paschal slaughter was performed, quote, as written in the Torah of Moses, it's remarkable that none of the Levitical activities just described have any Pentateuchal basis, i.e., you can't find what it says is in the Torah of Moses. It's not in the five books of Moses as we have. Neither their role in the Paschal slaughter, nor their role in aiding the priests in sprinkling the blood of the Paschal offering, nor again their role in performing the burnt offering. So it's interesting that the writer of 2 Chronicles says he is following, or they are following, the Torah of Moses. But if you were to look back at the Torah of Moses, that stuff ain't there. Again, what could this suggest? Again, an oral teaching or oral teachings that have been handed down from Moses to the author of 2 Chronicles. Asher?
Sure. Actually, I'll even bring up when Scott was moderating the debate between the Christian guy and the atheist. The Christian representative actually spoke about there being traditions in the New Testament. And he said, our difference with our fellow Jews is this. In Christianity, we believe that many of those traditions that they're talking about are man-made, where Jesus comes and he says, those are man-made traditions, etc. He goes, our difference is that we actually have traditions in Christianity, but we believe that those traditions are derived from God. And that would be the two. I don't know if you recall him mentioning that in his debate, but that's what he said to the atheist.
Yeah, and there's obviously some room for interpretation there as the hundreds of Protestant denominations should suggest it.
So I'm going to turn the time over to Asher, who's going to be talking about Jewish messianic expectations and why Judaism does not accept or is not convinced by the Christian truth claims regarding Jesus being Messiah.
Is it of note that the one who's presenting the commonality is wears white, and the one who's going to attack wears black?
There you go.
All right, so I have a different set of papers than he does, but it's stapled in with you guys. So if you guys turn the page, mine should start off with where it says Messiah. So I thought I would begin with this because Scott ended with this last week when we were having our conversations. So if you guys want to read along with me, I'll read it. So it says, Rabbinic Judaism, unlike Christianity, does not believe that the Messiah, in Hebrew there it says HaMashiach, is Jesus or Yeshua. The noun Mashiach, translated as Messiah, annotatively means anointed one. In the Tanakh, or the Hebrew Bible, or the Christian Old Testament, the term Messiah, Mashiach, is used for patriarchs, kings, high priests, and possibly even a group of people. I give some examples here in the Tanakh. Mashiach is used 39 times. If you guys go, say, for example, the Blue Letter Bible, look it up, the word, or your Strong's Concordance, you'll see the word Mashiach, and it will list it 39 times. We have 2 patriarchs, 6 high priests, 29 Israelite kings, such as Saul and David, Cyrus, a non-Israelite king, and where you can find them in Isaiah 45:1, and 1 unidentified person or a group of people in Habakkuk 3:13. Not once is the word Mashiach, Messiah, directly used in reference to HaMashiach, the Messiah, anywhere found in the Hebrew Bible. So already we have a little bit of a difference by how we look at the text and the way Christians understand Messiah. Usually when I heard it, it was like the Messiah is a savior. There is a very close Hebrew word called Moshiach, which actually refers to as savior or something. So notice how close those two words are, Moshiach and Mashiach. One thing, there's 2 types of pronunciations in Hebrew that we use today. One is the Sephardic one. In other words, those from the Middle East, Spain, Yemen, Iraq, and so on. And the other one is an Ashkenazi one. Those from Europe, and my family, say for example, is from Lithuania. So my family, when they say the word Mashiach, and Ashkenazi Hebrew say Moshiach. And if your ear is not attentive to it, you will miss the CH or KH sound at the end, and you will actually think that they're the same word that they're saying. They're not. So let's go ahead. Let's turn the page here. So in debate, for when I started, I went to James Madison High School in Vienna, and I was part of the debate club. And being in the debate club, we had these rules for debate, and I've carried these over for a long time. And as you guys can see, the 10 commandments of rational debate. So the first one is thou shall not, you shall not, attack the person's character, but the argument itself, right? No ad hominem. I think Effie dresses funny, so that's why his conclusions are just silly. So that's an ad hominem attack, right?
Yep.
There you go. So we can't use that kind of stuff. But here, if we scroll down this a little bit to number 8, you shall not lay the burden of proof onto him that is questioning the claim. In other words, burden of proof reversal. So the question that I often get is so why do Jews reject Jesus as the Messiah? Well, Christians are the ones that's making the claim that Jesus is the Messiah. So the burden of proof rests on them. We're not the ones who's coming and making the positive claim. It's Christianity that's coming and making the positive claim. So this is automatically where, even just in civil rational discourse, that's where it lies, right there. So the burden of proof, say for example, is on Christianity. So in a minute, we'll turn the page. You guys can already go ahead and turn there if you like, because I'll be speaking about it in a second. So I'll start with this. Is it rational to believe that Jesus is the Messiah? I would say yes. However, this claim or belief in and of itself is not proof that Jesus is the Messiah. So let me give you an example. I'll do a bank robber story. Person goes into a bank, robs the bank, he comes flying out, and no cameras catch him, but witnesses do. It's a bank in Eden, Texas. And as a result, the police put out an APB for him, they're searching, looking everywhere, and they go ahead and they round up some people. And they find somebody, 2 or 3 people, and they're like, oh great, so now let's go ahead and round up the witnesses, put them behind, and they're going to identify who they saw robbing the bank. Well, as a result of this, A judge decides that they're going to go ahead and they will have a trial. And in the trial, the prosecution makes all of its arguments. The defense comes out and says, you know, that's great that we have eyewitness testimony, but look, you guys already saw that you picked out three people that it could possibly be. That's number one. Number two, you have no DNA evidence that he was there. Three, you have no fingerprints that my client was there. That's it. The only thing that you have is some people said that it's him, but it could have also been this other person, and it could have also been this other person. The jury goes back, and they go, you know what? Between the three, I swear, the guy who's on trial right now is the one who did it, but we don't have enough proof, enough evidence to convict him and put him away for 25 years. But I do. I believe it's him. It's reasonable to believe that it's him. Here's an example from a little while ago. The George Zimmerman juror said, in our hearts, we felt he was guilty, but they didn't have enough. That's what they felt. That's what they believed. Do I believe that it's reasonable to go ahead and have this kind of belief? Sure. But is there enough proof to go ahead and make the clinch that such and such, this person was a bank robber, or George Zimmerman was really not a good guy, or whatever? As a juror, they just weren't totally persuaded. So, us in Judaism have the same perspective. There's a claim that Jesus is the Messiah. There's literature, i.e. the New Testament, that makes the claim that Jesus is the Messiah. But if I went like this, just because somebody writes something doesn't make it true, does it? Because, say, for example, do Mormons, do they have additional scriptures?
Yep.
They wrote things, and they make claims about Jesus and the New Testament and the Hebrew Bible, the Old Testament, and so on, right?
Yep.
Well, just because somebody wrote it, does it make it true?
Nope.
No, it doesn't make it true. So already, that burden of proof is being placed from Judaism's vantage point back on Christianity. And they're going, so, where is it? Where is it at? So, what I like to do, we have the normal Christian proofs. Ebby, would you actually write for me?
Sure.
The normal Christian proofs that would go across the board, no matter which website that I went to, any book that I would go to, etc., it would center around these three. Isaiah 7:14. Whatever, anybody here object to Isaiah 7:14 being a proof of Jesus? Every single website that I've ever gone to, Isaiah 7:14. The next one would be Psalm 22, specifically Psalm 22:16. The other one would be Isaiah 53. Isaiah 53. So, let's start with Isaiah 7:14. Usually, what Jewish common missionaries do is that they come in and they single in on a word, Alma. Hine ha'alma hara ve'yoledet. How would that go?
Yep, that would be, in Christian translations, you'll find it as a virgin. Behold, a virgin shall conceive and give birth. Although now you'll find some say young woman instead of virgin.
So usually what they do is that they come in and they say, oh, the word Alma right here means young woman. I don't play this because here's the idea that I already encountered with any language, regardless of whether it's English, it's Hebrew, it's Aramaic, Greek, you name it. If I were, say, for example, to write this word, gay. So I was watching a movie, black and white, from the 1940s, and this word meant happy. And they were using it all over the movie. Up, down, left, and right, and this was the description. But now, today, 2015, 2014, 1997, 98, etc., this word took on a different meaning. So it is possible that the word Alma at one time did mean virgin. It's possible. So I'll grant them that, 100%. But if that's the case, let's go ahead and look at Isaiah 7:14. So I have a New King James Bible here. So Scott and I have one thing in common. We like to go ahead and go to, for example, if you're dealing with an atheist, you quote from atheist literature. If you're talking to Mormons, use Mormon literature. If you're talking to Christians, you use Christian literature. So I'm here in Isaiah 7:14. And I'm going to go ahead and read the English translation. Therefore, the Lord himself will give you a sign. Behold, the virgin shall conceive and bear a son, and shall call his name Emmanuel. Great. So I'm going to start with Isaiah 7:1. Isaiah 7:1. Now it came to pass in the days of Ahaz, the son of Jotham, the son of Uzziah, king of Judah, that Rezin, king of Syria, and Pekah, the son of Remaliah, king of Israel, went up to Jerusalem to make war against it, but could not prevail against it. So let me tell you what the context of the immediate surrounding is. There is a divided kingdom, the southern kingdom of Judah, the northern kingdom of Israel. One of the things that is problematic that I encountered early on is that when you see the term or name Israel, it's not always referring to the same people, person, thing, etc. So, for example, we have a place in the Bible that says God divorced Israel. Say, what? Well, God divorced Israel. There you have it. But the context is that it's the northern kingdom of Israel that God is divorcing, and he's super, super upset with. So you will see, I actually have in some of my papers here, all of the prophets during, and it's a Christian timeline of this, where all the prophets are either in during the divided kingdom. Hosea is a prophet to the northern kingdom. Isaiah is a prophet in the southern kingdom. So when they're both referencing Israel and so on, they are referencing sometimes the collective people of Israel, and sometimes they're referencing the northern kingdom of Israel, right? So we're going to go ahead, we're going to continue here. And it was told to the house of David, saying, Syria's forces are deployed in Ephraim. So his heart and the heart of his people were moved as the trees of the woods are moved in the wind. So we go ahead and we read through all of here until we get to 7:14. So I'm going to go from 7:14 and I'm going to read just a little bit past. I'm going to start with 15. Curds and honey he shall eat, that he may know to refuse the evil and choose the good. For before the child should know to refuse the evil and choose the good, the land that you dread will be forsaken by both her kings. The Lord will bring the king of Assyria upon you and your people and your father's house, days that have not come since the day that Ephraim departed from Judah. Effie, I didn't know you departed from Judah.
I didn't either.
So here we go. So now I'm going to go ahead and I'm going to read this in what I would call Christianese. So I'm going to start at 13. Then he said, hear now, O house of David. Is it a small thing for you to weary men, but you will weary my God also? Therefore, the Lord himself will give you a sign. Behold, the Virgin Mary shall conceive and bear a son, Jesus, and shall call his name Emmanuel. Curds and honey he, Jesus, shall eat, that he may know to refuse the evil and choose the good. For before the child, Jesus, shall know to refuse the evil and choose the good, the land that you dread will be forsaken by both of her kings. If that's about Jesus, then what's the problem here? This has an immediate context. For the Jewish eye, for the Jewish mind, they go, this is not concerning a prophecy. Is it possible? Sure. Is it a proof? No. they automatically, by looking at this, if I were to ask you with the verses 16 and 17, before the child Jesus shall know to refuse the evil and choose the good, the land that you dread, who's you, King Ahaz, you, King Ahaz, dread, will be forsaken by both her kings. The Lord will bring the king of Assyria upon you and your people and your father's house, days that have not come since the days that Ephraim departed from Judah. What's fascinating is
yeah, but Jesus was not a prophet. Jesus is the Son of God.
Yeah. He
is God.
And I apologize. I know you all walked in afterwards. We're giving them the floor uncontested initially, and then we will interject it.
So here's the paper. Once again, I love you, Matthew. This is from Professor Craig Blomberg, from Professor of New Testament at Denver Seminary. So you guys can go ahead and you guys can come and check this out. This is what he says on the second page of this. Because of the controversy spawned by Isaiah's famous prophecy of a virginal conception, it might seem unwise to begin with this illustration. But in fact, it seems to me one of the clearest examples and one that sets the stage for several others. Despite staunch conservative resistance to the idea, I cannot see how the plain meaning of Isaiah 7:14, 7:15, before the boy knows enough to reject the wrong and choose the right, the land of the two kings you dread will be laid waste, can mean anything other than that Isaiah believes the child he has just described will be born within his lifetime as a harbinger of the destruction by Assyria, of kings Rezin of Aram and Pekah of Ramalia, which you see I read in 7 verse 1. This is from Professor Craig Blomberg. You're aware of him, right? And he just says, I'm sorry, folks, that's just not tenable to have that as a plain meaning. So actually, next week, when we talk about the Jewish relationship to the New Testament, we will describe a little bit about how Matthew used Isaiah 7:14. But at the moment, I'm going to leave it as, that's not the plain meaning of Isaiah 7:14. The context does not dictate it. Let's move to the second one. We'll go to Psalm 22:16. Psalm 22:16. So I'll let you know, and actually in Hebrew Bibles, we have it as Psalm 22:17, just because we count it just a little bit different. So here we go. So I'll start at 15. My strength is dried up like a potsherd, and my tongue clings to my jaws. You have brought me to the dust of death, for dogs have surrounded me. The congregation of the wicked has enclosed me. They pierced my hands and my feet. And this right here, I have the reference to Matthew 27:35. I count all my bones. They look and stare at me. They divide my garments among them. And for my clothing, they cast lots, Matthew 27:35. But you, O Lord, do not be far from me. O my strength, hasten to help me. Deliver me from the sword, my precious life, from the power of the dog. Save me from the lion's mouth and from the horns of the wild oxen. And then it continues. Well, the Jewish problem with Psalm 22 is quite simply this. It says, it begins with Psalm 22:1. To the chief musician, said to the deer of the dawn, a psalm of David, my God, why have you forsaken me? Why are you so far from me, from helping me, and from the words of my groaning? Oh my God, I cry in the daytime, but you do not hear, and in the night season, and am not silent, and so on. Well, so most Christians read this as what? A prophecy of the crucifixion. There's only one problem. There's no mention, A, of a person, Jesus, here. Two, there's no mention of any crucifixion. So in Psalm 22, 16, say, for example, they pierced my hands and my feet. We would call this eisegesis. You're reading something into the text that is not there. They pierced my hands and my feet. I could take Ephraim, put him on the ground, and nail his hands and feet to the floor. So he cannot get up, and then ants come and they devour him. That's one possibility. Another one is that they pierce the person's hands and feet to a tree. Or it could be to a cross. Or it could be that it refers to the crucifixion, but this is not proof of one. There's no name Jesus there. And two, there is no mention of anything about crucifixion. Once again, you're reading something, a person's reading something and going, oh, that's where it's connected. It's not proof enough. In other words, the Jewish claim is that they don't buy it. That in and of itself. But we'll move to another one. Let's go to Isaiah 53. This is usually the big one. So Isaiah 53, who has believed our report, and to whom has the arm of the Lord been revealed? For he shall grow before him as a tender plant, and as a root out of dry ground. He has no form or comeliness, and when we see him, there is no beauty that we should desire him. He is despised and rejected by men, a man of many sorrows, and acquainted with grief. And we hid, as it were, our faces from him. He was despised, and we did not esteem him. Surely he has borne our griefs and carried our sorrows, yet we esteemed him stricken, smitten by God, and afflicted. But he was wounded for our transgressions. He was bruised for our iniquities. The chastisement for our peace was upon him, and by his stripes we are healed. And then it continues. Most people, obviously, as being a Christian, you believe that Jesus is the Messiah. So therefore, what I was mentioning last week in some of our Q&A discussions was quite simply this. Since you believe that Jesus is the Messiah, you read in the New Testament that he was crucified, you look at the life and all of the claims that he made, you then go back and go, oh, that's referring to Jesus. But Christians aren't the only ones who do this. Jews also do this too. We have famous rabbis throughout history that they have applied Isaiah 53 to, even to the present day. The most current was a person named Rabbi Menachem Mendel Schneerson, who lived up in New York City in a place called Crown Heights, and they have applied Isaiah 53 to him. And so what we would say is that it's a matter of application. Despite which group that you are in, if you are a Sabbatean, in other words, Sabbateans, I don't know how many of you guys know of a person named Shabbatai Tzvi. Effie, what time did he live during?
1600s.
During the 1600s, and he was traveling around the Middle East and Europe. And in fact, there is an incredible book written by Gershom Scholem that documents his life, his times, his travails, and all those types of things. This person ended up, in the end, converting to Islam after being captured by Muslims. But during his time, he was performing miracles. All these types of things were happening all over the Middle East and in Europe. And as a result, even Christians in Europe were going, maybe that's Jesus. Man, oh my God. And as a result of him doing all of this, when he started suffering his persecution, Isaiah 53 was applied to him. So in and of itself, there's no mention of Messiah anywhere in Isaiah 53. There's no mention of Jesus anywhere in Isaiah 53, nor Menachem Mendel Schneerson, nor Shabbatai Tzvi, or anybody else for that matter. So this text, Isaiah 53, actually has, they would say, multiple applications. One application is that this is part of the servant psalms. We have numerous servant psalms that talk about the servant being who, Effie? Israel. Israel. It's in all throughout Isaiah 40. 40, 41, 42, 44, etc. that the servant is Israel. We also have other places that talks about the servant actually being a person. So it could go either way. Either it's Israel, or it's a person, or it could be both. But for this to be a clincher, I would submit to you that this is not a clincher for a jury to go ahead and say, Jesus is the one. However, here's the thing that we would end with, which would be this. If you guys look at your paper, it says you have the 13 principles of faith of Maimonides.
And by the way, you've heard this name a couple of times. Maimonides is, I won't say a central figure, but a very key figure in Jewish rabbinic thought, and is probably, maybe you can say, the greatest defender of Judaism.
He was very famous.
So a lot of good writings, and so Maimonides is a good person to study for these kinds of things.
If you look, I actually don't have one in front of me. Can I borrow one of yours?
Go ahead.
Thank you. So if you look at number 12, it says, I believe with perfect faith in the coming of the Messiah. And even though he may tarry, nonetheless, I wait every day for his coming. This is one of the essentials of faith, to actually believe in the Messiah. If you don't believe in the Messiah, you are considered outside of Judaism. So let me say that again. It's one of the essentials of faith to believe in the Messiah. But if you don't believe in the Messiah, you're outside of Judaism. What's fascinating about this text is actually that if you read right underneath it, if a king will arise from among the house of David, who is learned in Torah and observant of the mitzvot, that means the commandments, as prescribed by the written law and the oral law, which what Effie here described to you, as David, his ancestor, was, and will compel all of Israel to walk in the ways of the Torah and reinforce the breaches and fight the wars of God, we may, with assurance, consider him the Messiah. If he succeeds in the above, builds the temple in its place, and gathers the dispersed of Israel, he is definitely the Messiah. If he did not succeed to this degree, or he was killed, he surely was not the Redeemer promised by the Torah. So usually Christians counter with, but Mr. Rabbinic Jew, you get this wrong. Jesus is actually going to do these things when he comes back. The place where Jews and Christians, Rabbinic Judaism and Christianity, has something in common is this. All of the things that Christianity believes that Jesus will do when he comes back, he's going to, Isaiah 11:10. He's going to go ahead and bring the ingathering of the exiles. Jeremiah 23, 5 and 6. Jeremiah 33, 14 and 15. All of these things about rebuilding the temple, bringing the Jews back into the land, making the world where everybody is going to go ahead and get on their knees and bow and proclaim that God is, in fact, the true God, and such person is the true Messiah. Both Judaism and Christianity will hold this in common. Our difference is two things. One, the identity of the person, Jesus or not Jesus. We have a joke in Rabbinic Judaism that when the Messiah comes, is this your first time in Jerusalem? In other words, Judaism is open to the fact that it could be Jesus. It's possible. However, at the moment, they're not convinced or persuaded that it is. So that's kind of how that works with that. I'll do a couple of additional ones so then you guys can go ahead and do some Q&A. Belief in the Messiah is a salvational issue in Judaism, as you guys saw in the 13 principles of faith. We do have the concept of vicarious atonement in Judaism. In counter-missionary types of Judaism, they teach that it's not, that it's incorrect. I can read from the prayer book and demonstrate various places of vicarious atonement. Here are two places from Israel National News. Right here, Israel National News, Channel 7. I'll read a little snippet from each one. So this is a Rabbi Abu Katsera, who was assassinated. He was killed. Rabbi Shlomo Amar, the chief Sephardic rabbi of Israel, made similar comments to Arok Sheva on Friday. Who knows what kind of decree God's people was under? And Rabbi Abuchatzera was strong for us, and he bore the atonement for our generation. We have this notion of vicarious atonement in rabbinic Judaism, despite if you guys ever go online and you hear people say, no, we don't, we do. Just tell them, Asher here told you that we do, and I have proof of it. Here's another one. Recently, a bunch of people were praying in a synagogue, in Jerusalem, and it says, I heard the story, replied Rabbi Kanievsky. The Mashiach, Messiah, has to come. The Haredi leader, that's the ultra-Orthodox Jewish leader, explained that, quote, there needs to be an atonement for the generation so as to merit the coming of the Messiah. An atonement, he argued, the victims of the terror attack partially made. Here's another case of where they believe in vicarious atonement. If they tell you otherwise, once again, we do have evidence of vicarious atonement. And with that being said, we can go ahead and open up the floor for a Q&A. I'll let you know one thing. Both Ephraim and I were both rabbinical school students, so we have to actually field questions. This is a requirement. So, guys, go ahead, and we have about 5-10 minutes to field
questions. Yeah, we got 10 minutes. I know there are some that may have to leave now, but first, thanks to these two Lions of Judah for diving into here. We appreciate that very much. And like we said, for anybody that's got to go, we'll go up until about 10:40, and then anybody that needs to leave in the meantime can, but then we have to break down for the Spanish church. The gentleman will be here next week, but we'll also retire, hopefully, to a different classroom than the one that was so tight last time. We borrowed the elders' room last time. These guys were very kind enough to bundle into that tight room with us. Although, I will say this, if you ever want to quickly size up whether a man's a dangerous man, you see a man with cauliflower ear, step back. His chances are, as he knows how to take a beating, he probably just won. So the first question, I'll start off just with an easy one. Are there rabbinic traditions or a tradition that see these verses as messianic? Yes, the context of it is immediately to Ahaz and other folks in some of the cases. Do any rabbinic traditions identify these as messianic?
The answer is absolutely. Almost all of the verses that Christianity believes are messianic and or alluding to the Messiah, rabbinic Judaism, you can find all throughout the Talmud, the Midrash, and so on, will agree with you. Yep, that's Messiah. Yep, that's Messiah. Yep, that's Messiah. Once again, our difference will be just this. It's application. That's it. So for those that were Sabbateans, they would say, Genesis 3:15, that refers to Sabbatai's feet. A Christian's going to say Genesis 3:15, that's Jesus. Us, well, we just don't know. So, and that would be a second common thing that people ask, well, if you don't know who the Messiah is, then who is it? My comment immediately back is, well, who's the Antichrist? Who is he? Right? The text has an Antichrist there, and in the New Testament, so who is he? There's no name given, no nothing. Well, various Christian commentators have proffered, sometimes it was the Pope, sometimes it was this, and so on. So it's the same kind of nature. We're in the same boat, so to speak. Oh, go ahead.
I am the Antichrist.
Okay.
I don't have a question, but I just have a comment. It's nice to not be the only Daniel in the lion's den.
No, that's all.
Yeah, Jesus claims in the New Testament, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. Do you think he was claiming to be the Messiah with that statement? And if not, what could he possibly have meant by that statement?
So, actually, we were going to cover that next week, but I'll do like a small one right now. So, I am the way, the truth, and the life. We can find the statement, actually, in rabbinic literature. How? Almost every rabbi who has a disciple or student, this is how it would go. You have God, you have your teacher or your rabbi, And then you have the Talmidim, or the students. The only way to God, according to the New Testament, is who? Is Jesus, your teacher. That's the only way. Just as he said, I am the way, the truth, and the life. Right? In Rabbinic Judaism, we have the same concept. The only way to God is through a mediator. Just like the New Testament says, there's only one way to God is through the mediator, Christ Jesus. You guys can go ahead and Google that and you will find that. We have the same concept. The only way to God is through a mediator, either if you look in the Torah, the high priest, or, of course, during the Second Temple period, we're going to say that it's your teacher or your rabbi. So we would call, in Hebrew, this is called derech, or path. So your path to God is your Rebbe, your rabbi, your teacher, and so on. So that would be how we would interpret the Jewish nature of that comment.
Okay, so when John the Baptist said, here's the Lamb of God who takes away the sins of the world.
Right.
He was referring to Jesus. Was there someone else? I mean, who would fit that particular description except the Messiah?
So this is where a place that would differ between what Christianity or the author of the New Testament, you say John, correct?
I forget which gospel it's in, but okay. John the Baptist.
But so I believe it's in the book of John. So, as I just pointed out, we have people that atone for the sins of a generation or whatever.
But ultimately, immaterial there.
So, this would be another difference. The scope of the atoning nature of the Messiah. So, for example, since the Messiah is higher than the ministering angels, ooh, it's pretty high. He's higher than the patriarchs, ooh, pretty high. Rabbinic Judaism doesn't believe that he could atone for the sins of all mankind and the entire world. This is where we would differ, say, for example, with the author of whoever wrote that gospel. So, obviously Christianity believes it is. You believe that it is. We don't believe that somebody could actually do that. So you won't find such a statement like that, say, for example, in the Hebrew Bible. But you do in the New Testament. And my response would be, just because it's written doesn't make it true.
Right. The New Testament is taking a look back at the Old Testament, especially in the book of Matthew.
Right.
Where it's saying, okay, here's something that happened, and this fulfills this prophecy. Here's another one that happened, and it fulfills this. And certainly it's the lens through which we look back.
But also, LDS literature does the same thing. It goes back into the New Testament, it also goes back into the Hebrew Bible, and it makes those links common. And you would go, well, just because Joseph Smith wrote that stuff doesn't make it true.
Sure.
Right, so that would be like one of our contentions. Hold on, let me let him go.
Within the Orthodox Jewish tradition, is there any view that the Messiah will be a spiritual Messiah as opposed to a political Messiah, or is everyone of the belief that this is really, Messiah must be a political Messiah?
Actually, both. So if you read, like, that place where Maimonides was writing, at the very bottom here, the first part of it is a king will arrive from the house of David who is learned in Torah and observant of the commandments as prescribed by the written and oral law, as David his ancestor was, and will compel all of Israel, in other words, the people, to walk in the way of the Torah and reinforce the breaches, and so on. So for them to walk in the way of Torah, notice, right after that it talks about fighting the battles of God and stuff. So it's both a person who is going to, of course, preach like about the one true God of Israel and so on, plus with the addition of being a political and military type of thing. So which is what you see in the New Testament, where they're trying to figure out, so is Jesus a political person, and he's saying that I'm speaking in spiritual terms and so on. We believe that it's both. And which I believe that Christians also believe too, that Jesus is going to come back and politically rule the world, right?
Right.
So he's not just a spiritual person, he's also a political person. There's going to be one world government under Jesus.
And let me ask one other thing. What I intended to do, let me do this now. Week 3, I intended to cover some of these data, but rather than let these guys leave and say, okay, now that they're gone, let me tell you some of our answers to this. That doesn't seem exactly fair.
if you guys want to come back that third week, we can make the third week entirely a Q&A discussion selling ground style, so you don't have to fit all your rounds.
And we'll stay all day today. You guys can field questions all day.
All right, great. Thank you all very much.
Sorry. Question, if you have a hierarchy of God, Israel, and the Torah, is there a condition where you would replace what you have as a practical understanding of the law with a concept that actually coming from God that, you know, is not necessarily written down, is actually a higher order, as in Mount Chesedek, that the Messiah actually is a higher order than we had in the law, because the law hadn't been presented, that there is something out there besides, you know, what we know definitively, as in, you know, the Messiah that we can't actually ascertain based on what we have in writing?
Well, one of the things that I did mention, we believe the Torah has actually existed 2,000 years before creation. It, in fact, was the blueprint for creation. So it actually is the highest, it itself. But that understanding means that it's not merely the history and the laws. If you really understand the oral teachings that were given to Moses and written down by Shimon bar Yochai, that's where you're going to find all of the deep, inner, whatever word we'd like to use, spiritual meaning that is really embedded in the Torah itself. That is beyond just the mere, Abraham went into Egypt. All right, that's nice, thank you very much, and, or the genealogies and, you know, numbers. Oh, that's really cute. What else? But there really is something much deeper embedded in that, and this is the code that God used to convey this information to us.
There, what was interesting is actually, he asked me last week, he goes, how did God create the world, the universe? And you remember what I said?
Yes.
And I said, with his word. So we believe that God proverbially, I don't know how you want to say it, like opened up the heavenly Torah scroll, looked into it, and he started reading from it and making his commands. And this is how the universe came into being, which he gave the analogy of like guitar strings and playing music and the waves traveling. That's how we believe that it worked.
Does Judaism think that the God of the New Testament is the same as the God of the Torah? That it's the same deity?
Yes. So, in fact, we were going to cover that next week, too. There's a thing that was written a while back by a bunch of professors and rabbis and so on, called Dabru Amet, the words of truth, in which a bunch of Jewish scholars and rabbis and so on from all different denominations affirm this statement that both Judaism and Christianity believes in the same God. However, I'll tell you a fascinating question, though, that I encountered while debating people online. Well, that's great, Asher. So if you believe that God, your God, and the Christian God is the same one, why don't you believe the words of the New Testament? If you believe that he's communicating the same way. Ooh, good question. We'll cover that one next week, too.
Nice book.
A teaser.
Looking at the diagram of Talmudic dialogue,
yes.
There's a lot of names here.
Yes.
So I'm curious, what would qualify someone to have their thoughts printed in the Talmud alongside the original writings?
So, that's a good question. The thing that would qualify it is actually this, their knowledge of the material and what they can demonstrate. So in other words, what qualifies you to write a commentary on the Bible versus, I'll just put someone, Matthew Henry. Most people think that Matthew Henry is a pretty good commentator. He can demonstrate his material, and I'm not picking on you. Maybe perhaps you can, you know, go ahead and write a commentary on the Bible and so on. But it would be that type of nature. So it's those people who could actually do this material. They know it well. The community recognizes that they really are experts in what they do because they didn't have PhDs and stuff like that. So they had rabbinical degrees. And the first time, in fact, that we see the term rabbi ever in any recorded text is sitting right there in the New Testament. So like Paul sitting at the feet of Gamaliel. Well, what makes Gamaliel so popular? Everybody recognized him as a big Torah scholar, and that's why Paul went to go study with him.
So one more round of applause for these gentlemen. We're... wrap up, one, I think I need to issue a correction. Did I say James was Yusuf or Yahu?
Yusuf, Yusuf.
Okay, so a testimony of their grace is they didn't correct me on the spot. Yaakov, Jacob, is James's transliteration, the correct rendering of it. So here's what I would say, a challenge to solid ground and to Christians in general. Dennis can ignore me for now, although no big task, right?
It's impossible.
Is the Christian right to be critical of the Mormon? Is he right to be critical of the Jehovah's Witness? Is he right to be critical of the other part of Christianity that doesn't conform to what we believe are true? Now, we would, of course, say, yes, we are right to do so. But although I don't think the parallel is exact, that Christians are to Jews as Mormons are to Christians, it's not terribly dissimilar in that it is an addition or a interpretation of teaching that, and in fact, claims canonical scripture in addition to the scripture that was considered canonical by the original group. All that to say this, can and should you be able to answer Jewish objections to Christianity? You should, and I would say this further, if you can't, you ought to put yourself in the same shoes as the Mormon that you're asking to do the same thing. That is to say, if your counter objections to the objections of Judaism are not sufficient to convince you, then you ought not be a Christian. This is about the pursuit of truth. If God's truth is that Judaism is true, then that will be supported both by Scripture, in nature, and ultimately the Spirit of God will tell you the same thing. But Christians shouldn't take a pass and say, well, the Holy Spirit has told me that this Scripture is true. Who's who also says that exactly? The Mormon. The burning in the breast tells me that although there's no archaeological evidence whatsoever for any of this stuff, it's still true. But we should not stand in those same positions. So what I would say to you is this. If you find this a threat to your belief system, study it. Learn it. And you will be walking in good sandals because Paul did the same thing. And Jesus did the same thing. And remember what they used to convince both Jews and Gentiles of the truth of Christianity, of Jesus being the Messiah. They went to the scriptures and demonstrated it. Bereans next door are the people who, when they heard the claims of Christianity, where did they go? Back to the scriptures. What scriptures did they have at the time? Only the Old Testament. So if you cannot go to the Old Testament and find that Jesus is the Messiah, or Yeshua is the Messiah, then there's something wrong. So I would encourage you to do that. I would challenge you to do that. And I don't mean to just stand up and undercut and say what they're saying is not right. These points are good points and must be met, or they must be acquiesced to. Fair enough. All right. So with that encouragement, thank you all very much, and let's collect a break.